be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, I'm at Falcon Screen, and we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Yellow.
And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
I'm blue, dubba-dee-dubba-die.
Now, there's a slight delay between our respective voices because we are social distancing and recording on Zoom, as we have been for the past few months, and we are getting out a little, seeing people in and about. We're just going into cinemas. Cinemas are back open. Chris, you went to the Ritz last night?
Yeah, last night I saw 8.5. I hadn't watched that in like 6 years. Seven, no, probably longer. Probably like 8, 9 years. Yeah, you know, it's great.
It would have been funny if you hadn't seen it for 8.5 years.
It's probably correct, actually, yeah. When I think of it. But yeah, it's a great film, isn't it?
I last rewatched it when... it's one of my all-time favorite films. I last rewatched it when Birdman came out because it struck me just how similar they were in so many respects.
They're definitely riffing on 8.5 in Birdman, but 8.5 is
so much better.
Yeah, a lot better
than question.
I'm more of a La Dolce Vita fan, but...
Outstanding.
Yeah,
interesting. Birdman riffs a bit of La Dolce Vita too.
Do you guys prefer La Dolce Vita to 8.5?
I do.
No, I prefer 8.5. 8.5 is my favorite. Then I'd say Ivy Deloney.
Yes, such a brilliant film.
Yeah, beautiful.
I've said before that my regret about this program that they're playing at the Ritz at the moment is that they don't have Ivy Deloney and Knights of Cabiria, which
on Knights of Cabiria, it's fantastic.
And Satyricon's not playing, is it?
Satyricon is playing.
Good. Okay, good.
I think it's next week. But yeah, Ivy Deloney and Knights of Cabiria might be my favorites along with 8.5. But there's a new restoration of Knights of Cabiria that just premiered in the last year, I think, and it's showing in American cinemas like or was right before COVID. So hopefully we will see that sometime soon. It strikes me as one of the things that might have been programmed in the classics section of Sydney Film Festival were it to go ahead because it's a really high profile new restoration. Anyway,
that's true.
Fingers crossed for Knights of Cabiria.
Talking of American cinemas, last we were told that Tenet was indefinitely delayed. Now we have
been told
of a new release schedule and Tenet August, is coming to Australian.
Did you hear about this?
In September, the first week of September.
No, really? I thought it was late August still.
August.
I think it's 26th of August.
No, but that's all other. It's because they're stagnating released into different countries, not the US.
So it
reaches Australia, I think, first week of September.
This time I will hold my breath because I've been wrong so many times.
Let's see how this plays out.
September looks more likely. I think timeline-wise, August still was pushing it.
Yeah, look, I feel like this is a mistake. I feel like Warner Brothers need to just tell Chris Nolan to shut up and push it to 2021. I feel like this is going to lose a lot of money.
Yeah, if you're a Nolan fan, there's plenty of great stuff he's released that's underrated that you can go back and watch. I actually haven't seen Insomnia, so I need to go back and catch that.
What's the original as well?
We can wait for the new Nolan.
Yeah, but the thing about this Tenet strategy is... who actually wants to go out to the cinema in large numbers? Why is it so important to release the film now? Apparently, like the insider reporting in your trade magazines, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, etc., has always been that Nolan really cares about the viability of theaters and wants to keep them going. And he's worried that without a big release to bring some money to the theaters, they're going to go bankrupt. And there'll be no more theatrical experience for when the COVID situation is dealt with.
You don't want any particular spikes linked to this or any other event.
Imagine that's right. Imagine the bad PR if some of the sessions that do by coincidence have crowds, which I'm sure will happen, that ends up being the cause of a spike. That's going to backfire and keep people away from cinemas for a lot longer, right?
And Nolan being the darling of the masses, I'm pretty sure the public is pretty heavy. They have short-term memory. You can be a darling and a villain pretty quickly.
But then, look, it can prospectively release in jurisdictions where there is a much more mitigated concern, like in New Zealand or several jurisdictions where coronavirus, there are zero cases. And there are countries where that is certainly the case.
But
not the biggest cinema audiences, but you can go ahead in that circumstance.
Piracy is a big concern, but other regions where it'll not be released, there'll be a bootleg copy available, and then that will stop people from going and watching it.
Yeah, I was going to say that. The piracy means that people are inevitably going to see this in the US for months in advance of the release there in pirated versions. Not people who really care about watching the film in the best quality way, but possibly a significant portion of people.
Actually, the US release is not that long after the Australian release in September. So it's, I think, only a week after. So it's mid-September for the US.
Yeah, so they after delaying the movie because of COVID, they're releasing it in territories where suddenly we're seeing a big spike again. Is it really September when they're releasing it in the US?
Yeah, I looked at the Variety schedule. So it's all the other regions where there is...
I wouldn't go to a movie in the US right now.
That's so stupid.
Maybe US? No.
Yeah, that like there is less of a chance, like New Zealand and stuff. It's late August, 26, 27. And then in other territories, it's September. It's not that long.
Yeah, that's too soon to be releasing what's, at least on paper, a big crowd draw blockbuster in America. I really don't understand the thinking here. Something relevant. Okay, so Train to Busan made $24 million in its opening weekend in Korea, right? This weekend, the sequel opened in Korean cinemas, where Korea's had a really good COVID response, and they made $13 million. So
the sequel hang on. I'll issue a correction as of accurate dates. In Australia, it'll be 27th of August.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And the US, it's 3rd of September. It's a week after.
That's remarkable to me.
That seems really stupid.
But again, I've seen this delayed and changed so many times. I'm willing to wait the day before to believe that it actually is going to be released.
So actually, there's not much of a difference from like 26th of August till 3rd of September. It's literally
a week. It's a major difference for the purposes of piracy. It's a Nolan film. People are going to want to see it. It's the new
Sky. Especially because... Yeah, especially because the marketing around this has been really about the J.J. Abrams mystery box approach. It's been trying to create intrigue, and people are going to be able to go on Wikipedia and read everything that happens in the movie before it opens in the biggest market.
But honestly, I think that's the one benefit, because even after reading Wikipedia plot synopses, I did not understand Nolan movies until I saw them.
No, I had to see Inception a few times, but... I get you.
Yeah, hold on.
But the Wikipedia synopses actually do not make any sense, though.
Hold on. Do people actually think Inception was hard to understand? I'm not even trying to say, look how intellectual I am. Like, for me, they explain everything all the time.
There is a big section of the audience who feels...
too much explaining in Inception.
There's too much explaining. That's right. Inception would have been way better if you didn't know what was going on.
No, what I mean...
A little bit of dreamy mystery to it.
To clarify, the second time was to establish just in my mind how many layers there were, but moreover, my view on the ending, which hasn't changed.
But that's the thing, you know. Everyone wanted a think piece around what did the ending mean. So there were like 1,000 think pieces.
Yeah, that was a hilarious time. I still remember being in the cinema and seeing the top twirl and the big groan that comes up. Sorry for... Am I rooting the end of Inception?
Okay, Inception spoilers. I need to reply to Chris. No, I just called you Chris Nolan. No, I need to reply to the it's a dream thing. If anything, I think it was a rare moment of poetry in Nolan cinema. And the point is actually, it doesn't matter if it's a dream or not. I don't think even Nolan probably really knows.
Oh, I agree completely, but it's still a dream.
Maybe.
The internal logic of the story. Otherwise, we would have seen Marianne Cotillard's body after she fell off the building and other things.
Oh, maybe. I need to go back and rewatch it to know what you're talking about with this Marianne Cotillard thing, actually.
So what is our
in a dreamscape.
What's our official verdict? Was it a dream or not?
No, that it's a dream. It's definitely a dream, guys.
I would probably...
Open this 10-year-old debate.
If you held a gun to my head, I would say probably not a dream, but could be a dream. But like I said, the takeaway is sort of that it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like the point is that he walks away from the spinning top. Like he's not worried about whether it's a dream or not. Like that, I think that was the bigger thing.
See, that's still, I think, a very nuanced take than any of the think pieces that were deciphering it 10 years ago.
To my mind, the editing and visual cues implied that it was a dream. Certainly got more pronounced the further you went down the levels, but it was still there in what was considered the base level compared to the visual language of any number of his other films and film more generally. So
We've become what we hate. Oh my God. Nolan has made us into this.
So to rewind the conversation a bit, I was talking about the box office gross of the new Train to Busan movie in Korea, right? The original made $24 million. The sequel was way more hyped. Korea's had a brilliant COVID response and it made $13 million, slightly more than half what the original movie made in its opening weekend, despite being a way more hyped up sequel. If this trend holds worldwide, Tenet's not going to make that much money. People are still just cautious. You know, this is probably the first attempt at releasing a blockbuster in theaters since COVID-19 hit.
Absolutely, it's the first attempt. Like,
I meant that Train to Busan sequel.
What was it called? 2.
I think it's Train to Busan 2.
No, it has a name. I'm looking it up. Okay. For the Korean market, that was a blockbuster. So worldwide, that's probably the first attempt at releasing a blockbuster.
What I'm thinking is that Tenet would probably be re-released.
Peninsula. It's Train to Busan 2.
That's
Peninsula.
Right, yep.
I think it was going to be just called Peninsula, but then the studio said it has to be Train to Busan 2.
Or basically, just, you know, take in that marketing dollars. We need nostalgia, people.
We need the
branding. If it's a good sequel, that's fine. And it was a good original. So.
But wow. I think that just shows that even when COVID's well handled, people are just cautious. So I think the Tenet thing's going to backfire.
Tenet is probably going to re-release again next year to recover all the money it's lost.
But then it'll be away from the hype and the whole mystery thing.
No, it'll be like, no, watch it again now without the pandemic. So you're stressed.
Now, there'll be too many new movies to see in the case we can actually reopen the cinemas. People will want to see Mulan and Fast and the Furious and No Time to Die and maybe whatever Marvel decides to do.
It depends. I think no one really knows what's going to happen. There could be this big wave of all the movies getting released. I think studios will start to release their finished product if there's big demand. But on the other hand, what if
studios start losing money and we have return of mid-budget movies, which we give, one thing.
Which we discussed in a previous, I think the last episode.
Given the lack of production going on, I think it would be way more wise to space things out. What's going to be at the Oscars? Even with the eligibility extension of February.
And still, Old Guard, not the Old Guard.
Yeah, even with the not the Old Guard. Yeah, even with the eligibility extended till February, I don't feel like many or any Oscar bait movies are going to be finished.
I don't think many released anyway.
Chloe Zhao's new one, Nomadland, with Frances McDormand will be finished. That's one.
Maybe a lot of Netflix releases.
A bunch of things just released in the January, February window. And remember, Oscars, to their discredit, which we discussed in the previous episode, have extended the window. If people, studios were released, someone's being eligible, let them do the 12-month window as they would in any given year. It's favoring, as we've discussed before, a particular type of film, particular type of studio, and that's pretty unfair.
But that's what the Oscars always have been. They've never really been about quality or the best of the best. It's about favoring a certain type of film.
So just know what you're doing when you're getting into the Oscars. It's fun to watch and enjoy and tally and make fun of, but just know what you're
doing. Don't take it too seriously.
Yeah, when the Green Book wins, it happens. Just don't lose your shit.
But like the Green Book thing was barely the most egregious Best Picture win.
That's true. Like Crash won.
I was about to say horrible. That. Like Green Book, I think, is at least competent and entertaining. I get some enjoyment out of it. Crash is terrible. Dear God. Crash
is dated. Is bad, Chris.
Yeah, Crash is dated so badly in light of the current...
Crash was badly dated than 04.
Yeah, that's right. It was bad then, but watching it now, it's just like, how were these people that out of touch?
Even Monsters Ball was just a bit...
Monsters Ball didn't win Best Picture.
It didn't, but it got Halle Berry the Oscar, though.
I never saw it.
You dodged a bullet.
Okay. So
we should be clear. We sort of considered not doing an episode this week, so we're a little bit scattershot. But thanks for listening anyway.
I think the Oscars and the pandemic really galvanized us into discussing Tenet. Thank you, Tenet.
Things that make me angry.
Yeah, thank you, Chris Nolan, for actually giving us content.
Yeah, we could always fall, because we're film fanboys, we could always fall back at the Oscars of Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, there'll be stuff to say.
You know, that's the popular fanboys, bringing them to the yard.
And don't forget out, and Fellini, clearly we keep coming back to Fellini.
Have you seen Roma, by the way?
Roma?
The Fellini's Roma?
No.
No.
I haven't seen that. I'm not so, apart from Amarcord, which I think is brilliant, I am not so keen on his letter output, but I've never seen that one, so I feel like I should go out and...
We could do a Fellini retrospective episode. So
I'd have guys, so much fun just talking about Fellini for hours.
Yeah. So guys, now tell us which films we should pick for our retrospective.
And 8.5 and the Dolce Vita and Ivy Deloni and Satyricon and reference.
Am I the only one who finds Satyricon interesting but like kind of monotonous?
I've never seen
it's incredibly self-indulged, but it doesn't bother me because the scale of the production design and
it's amazing.
The whole nature of the mythos covered in it is just so interesting and intriguing to
me. That there is,
doesn't bother me.
I mean, his films have always been self-indulgent, but sometimes
Satyricon much more so than I think any other.
From La Dolce Vita onwards, it's massive self-indulgence, but usually, I think there's more poetry to hold it down, whereas poetry is the wrong word, but there's more grounding. Like, I'm willing to indulge self-indulgence if I'm super entertained, but in Satyricon, it starts to feel like one note for me. I get the point he's making, and he keeps hammering on that note for a long time. And it's, by design, a kind of aimless, wandering film of digressions, but when it's like that without... I'm not demanding a narrative progression, but after a while it starts to feel like it's so mired in one zone that there's no thrust behind it.
I think there's a fair gamut of archetypal narratives that he jumps between that isn't really static. I know
I'll watch it again. It's been 10 years since I saw it, so maybe I need to give it another shot.
I went to Rome once and I tried to find all the locations from his various films, including La Dolce Vita. And I went to my friend who had to be wearing a black dress to the fountain at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. We thought, no one's going to be here. We can do La Dolce Vita. And then
and everyone was doing it.
There were 100 people there. What the hell? I mean, I probably underestimate how famous the location is. Obviously, the Cherry Fountain location, but
and also everyone had the same thought of no one will be here. It's 2 a.m.
I tried, and yeah, you can't climb in the fountain. Big no-no, apparently.
Yeah,
Italian police are very strict. So things are happening around town. One thing is the French Film Festival, which screens till next week at Palace Cinemas. We're going to talk about a few of those films in a moment. The Melbourne Documentary Film Festival is screening online until August 2nd. I did an interview with Josh Belafonte, the director and producer of The World's Best Film, which is screening there. That's up on Falcon Screen and Festivus. That's one worth checking out. The Taiwan Film Festival is screening online until tomorrow night. Static Vision are going into their 14th week of screenings, especially with Alexander Helenikolas.
Remember when, like, 2 weeks ago, they were like, I guess we'll have a break? No.
Yeah, liars. Unstop, won't
stop.
Good on them.
Liars. Good on That's what you are. We don't trust you.
Yeah, but Felix Salah-Connell Bateman, we think you're liars, and you should go check out this.
But it's okay. You still put on great films.
Static Vision, that's S-T-A-T-I-C-V-I-S-I-O-N. Yeah, for the French Film Festival, that's happening. We've seen a few things. We covered Zombie Child in a previous week. I caught La Belle Epoque at the media opening night, which was quite a nice digression about how you remember the past. Is it worth having as a memory, or is it worth to what extent trying to relive it? A great meditation on the ideas of nostalgia, which was very sweet. I quite enjoyed that one.
The concept looked intriguing to me from the trailer.
Yeah, I saw Les Miserables earlier in the year because I was trying to go and hate watch it because I was sad that Portrait of a Lady was not France's pick.
It's coming on Stan, guys. Portrait of a Lady and Fire hits Stan very soon.
Portrait of a Lady, by the way, is a movie that Jane Campion directed.
Yeah, very different. Very different.
Yeah. Anyway,
so I was like, I'm going to probably go hate watch Les Miserables because, you know, how could it pay Portrait of a Lady on Fire to the post as France's official selection? And no, I could see merit. It was interesting.
It's decent?
It's more than decent. Yeah,
better or worse than Crash?
Definitely way better. If it weren't for my bias to...
And then Best Picture winner, Crash, 2008.
Yeah, high praise.
If it weren't for my bias towards Portrait of a Lady on Fire, then yeah, I would be more reasoned in my analysis, but I think I like it. It's okay.
Cool.
Not as bad as BPM.
Another nice one is The Swallows of Kabul, which is screened at the Veterans and Persian Film Festivals, which is an animation set in Kabul in wartime. The story was quite straightforward, but the quality of the animation, which evokes some of the great traditions of hand drawing, was very beautiful, and I liked it for that. If you are into animation, I think it's one worth checking out. So that's the French Film Festival is happening. The other thing we want to talk about is the big film news of the week, and that is the death of Olivia de Havilland at 104. She was born, July 1st, 1916. She lived through a lot. She was, by my reckoning, the last of the classic golden Hollywood era. She was the standout. She was the one who can speak to this incredible time in history. And she's now gone. Obviously, throughout her 20s and the 30s, she was very active in a lot of classic pictures, including Robin Hood, one of the films I used to watch quite a bit as a child, and which has still maintained the mold for every Robin Hood film to come. And she is my favorite Maid Marian. She starred in a lot of films alongside Errol Flynn, a fellow Tasmanian of ours. He's Australian, guys. And she did The Heiress, a number of other features, but she is most well known, of course, for playing Melanie in Gone with the Wind, one of the most revered films of all time. The film, which we'll address a little bit, was on the front page of Daily Telegraph a few weeks ago because of a controversy involving HBO Max. But turning to Olivia de Havilland, aside from her acting career, she had a very consequential role in the studio system because I think it was about 46 or so when the studio she was on the contract to said that, oh no, you owe us some extra years of servitude because she was contracted for so many years, but they said that there was times where she wasn't working because of holiday or whatnot, and that she owed cumulatively. And she said, no, that's unfair. Obviously, everyone else was under this sort of contract, or at least presumed to be. She took him to court and she won. And
it's weird to think that the studio system basically used a time and lieu kind of thing to basically make actors work a certain number of hours, which is, if you were to apply that today, that would be insane.
It would be insane. So it's set of years static, how's the length of your contract rather than a cumulative work, which had a huge impact to this day. I'm certainly most familiar with her from Gone with the Wind. Even in the final year, she was still propping up the news. She offered her views here and there, certainly on the miniseries that sought to portray her and Bette Davis's feud with Joan Crawford. I remember her discussing that in quite some detail a couple of years back.
Oh, what was that feud about?
So Bette Davis and Joan Crawford famously had a ongoing Hollywood feud where they didn't like each other. I don't know to what extent it was just media tabloids or what it
took through. Catfight.
What?
Said in the real spirit of Hollywood tabloids.
Yeah, yeah, I was trying to mimic the tabloids, like, ooh, catfight.
So she was obviously around at the time and she was known to, she was an acquaintance of theirs. Catherine Zeta-Jones portrayed her in the TV series, portrayed Olivia de Havilland, not in a favorable light. And Olivia de Havilland came out and said, okay, hold on a second. None of this is true. I'm alive. You could have called me and asked me about this, and this counts as defamatory. So what are you doing? And I think Ryan Murphy at the time said, oh, but like, we just didn't really want to bother her. But hey, like, she obviously was willing to set the record straight. So she's been... Oh,
I didn't know that Catherine Zeta-Jones was involved. She played Betty Davis? Is that
no, correct? She played Olivia de Havilland.
Wow.
I can't remember who played Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. Okay. And she was obviously also the sister of Joan Fontaine, lesser known Hollywood fact.
Yeah, interesting. I'm a huge Catherine Zeta-Jones fan, so I should have known that, but I didn't. But thank you for increasing my general knowledge.
With Olivia de Havilland, my favorite, very fond memories of her were from Gone with the Wind. She played Melanie Wilkes, and I adore the book more than I do the film. I actually have a first edition downstairs and very treasured little copy.
Wow, that must be worth something.
Just found it. I found it, and it's like this.
You found it?
I found it in the bookstore at the back of.
Sure.
I found what it
in
country?
In the Blue Mountains.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, first edition. Bottom level of bookstore, the like back, secondhand.
Published in the US?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah.
So guys, you know whose house to raid. If
I was about to say that.
Please don't raid Glenn's house. Please, please. I like my first edition Gone with the Wind.
In eBay, are you watching?
Yeah, please don't. I live in the Blue Mountains, yeah. So that's you should go look there for my house. So she played in the book... Melanie is really the soul of it, and she brought this warmth to the character which pervaded the entire feature. And obviously the central characters are ones who are quite cynical and ones you're in many respects supposed to dislike, but Melanie was the kindness that pervaded Gone with the Wind, and she had such a, as I said, warm, heartwarming, glowing qualities her where she carried off. And without that, Gone with the Wind is such a difficult watch, it's a difficult read, and as has been discussed broadly in the press, and I think we'll go and discuss in a minute, there are incredibly problematic elements to it, but there is a soul to it that was very much, if not wholly, her. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that the film has maintained its popularity and resonance decades later. It's still as easy to watch. I know it's 4 hours, but it just flies through even today. Good reason.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, it doesn't feel like 4 hours. It didn't feel like 4 hours when I first saw it as a kid either.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so I can't offer much commentary here.
I've rewatched it today because of this episode, so look at
I didn't have time to. I didn't have 4 hours, sorry. I wish I had, though. I
speed watched it, to be honest, so fair, to be fair, fair.
We appreciate you watching it for the episode, but as a general listener, please do not speed watch films.
Yeah,
avoid it. I love her like running towards Ashley at the beginning of one particular key sequence, just the affection she has for Scarlett, even though she knows what Scarlett's done, and particularly to her, it's an element of forgiveness and kindness, I mean, not many characters would have, and it's not something you necessarily believe in. So, like, why would someone be this faithful to someone so slavish? But she pulled that off because she tapped into what was a elemental human kindness, which she made believable in the context of the film and was necessary to propel and further the narrative.
The film is very judgmental towards its characters, except Melanie's arc. And I think that is what really helps you empathize with the other people, because she's the moral compass and she's almost also the sort of mushy compass as well of the film. So if there is a way for you to empathize, because otherwise it becomes really hard for you to empathize with anyone. And it became really apparent to me in the rewatch. And I'm like, why do I hate all of these people so much?
Well, they were slave owners for one.
I know. But that's true. A lot of that is very obvious.
Including Melanie's character, whose family owned slaves, you must acknowledge.
Yeah, the politics of the film, that's so obvious. So yeah, that's not held up pretty well. But
South will rise again bullshit.
it didn't hold up well a long time ago, but it's...
But still, it was interesting to see that despite all that, despite the political elements, the characters themselves didn't have much redeeming qualities for you to really see where your empathies as a viewer should lie.
And including Ashley. It's much more evident in the book that he's not as good a person as appears. In the film, they make him much more angelic, and until I think near the end, whereas in the book, he's a much more nuanced character, and one of the things the film was missing to a great extent.
So it's largely to Olivia and Melanie's portrayal that I was able to sort of navigate the film in a rewatch. So actually that's a big kudos to her performance, because otherwise every time she was on screen, I felt like okay, there is some sensibility to the whole kind of chaotic fatalism that I'm seeing on screen, which beyond a point, I was just like, why am I subjecting myself to this misery? But, you know, when she was on screen, I was like, okay, cool, there is a point to this, which is nice.
How do we feel about the recent HBO Max controversy involving Gone with the Wind?
Okay, so to give everyone a bit of context, and we're going to be going into this in more detail in the podcast, HBO Max in America, in the context of Black Lives Matter and like movements, and following a lot of protests over the years surrounding Gone with the Wind, without warning, pulled Gone with the Wind from their service. To be clear, it was just from HBO Max. It had no equivalent effect on any streaming services in Australia, where Gone with the Wind was at the time still very much available, and said that we're going to put the film back on with education resources or a video or something to give some context about the problematic elements of the film. They have since done that. This caused a big hubbub around the world, including the front page of Daily Telegraph, which talks about how Gone with the Wind has been taken. I think this happened in the same day. The Fawlty Towers episode was removed. The Don't Mention the War episode. I think it's subsequently put back on. My broad view on this is I don't have a problem with material being appended to movies. I don't have a problem with studios or anyone else adding essays or thoughts or perspectives. That's fine. It's similar to what we discussed in previous weeks regards Sydney Film Festival. I certainly don't think films should be edited. That wasn't what was done here. I do think HBO Max erred by taking it off the streaming service. They could have put something up even if it's in limited form, some contextual material in limited form immediately and added more. But to take it off, I think it diverges this from the importance of discussion, because people will just seek it out absent this, and it will make it a much bigger deal.
It does. It's like HBO Max is censoring this classic film. The headlines write themselves.
Yeah, they didn't need to.
The problem is the world we're living in mostly is about perception rather than what actually happened. So I think studios or any action is now scrutinized so closely that, you know, and headlines are almost misleading in every sense of the word. Even what happened with Sydney Film Festival didn't really capture the entirety and the nuance and the correct timeline of events which needed to be established for us to get the full details of the facts. So, you know, it's obvious that with HBO Max, this needs to be done. Or, you know, what happened, you know, it's all messy.
So to be clear, we're talking about the mukbang controversy, which we've covered in previous episodes of Film Fight Club.
Where I stand with this is, yes, censorship is definitely not okay. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure what educational resources are going to add to the thing in terms of experience of the film. You can seek them out if you need, and they exist in the wider discourse, and that's fine. But to add them to basically the film itself in terms of your experience of watching the film after as an additional item, it's different if it's a collector's or a home video edition, you know, where you have other commentaries and stuff which is included as part of the actual edition. But for a streaming service, I don't know what purpose or value does it serve. And just it feels like a knee-jerk reaction to first take it down, and then realizing that that's going to be taken in that negative light, which it was, and then put it back up again.
To be clear, it wasn't censored for several reasons. Number one, they're a private company who can choose to exhibit their own material, not. But number two, they didn't say we're going to take down permanently. They didn't say we're going to change it. They just said we're going to put it up with some extra info you can read. I think it was poorly handled. I think they should have just left it up and add what they could have added more later. To take it down draws attention to it in an unnecessary way. It means that the debate is not about the issues of Gone with the Wind. The debate becomes wrongly about censorship, and it just means people can access the film, otherwise seek it out absent context, which I think is important.
I agree. Basically, it was a non-issue that became an issue for no reason.
The thing about the feeling that they should put up some commentary before it, I actually understand it, and I agree with it, I would say, overall, because the problem is that if you just present the film without context, especially in the context of the discourse we're having today, people can view it as an endorsement. Like, see Gone with the Wind and 600,000, whatever it is, other great movies on HBO Max. Like, it's a selling point for our service. I think in an ideal world, everyone would be media literate enough.
Yeah, but that's enough the
to
thing,
say
right?
that the company doesn't necessarily endorse everything that they have on their service when they're presenting a film that's like 90 years old.
But even then, I feel like that's contributing to basically making us dumb as viewers, because yes, a lot of people may not have that media literacy, but isn't that part of engaging with any kind of media text?
It should be.
That you do the work, essentially, to understand the context in the right context. rather than applying your own lens from where you're coming from.
I think ultimately you're right. I think as a business decision, it makes sense given the current context. But I think the reality is also that we live in a world where there are people who want to reestablish the Confederacy. You know, I understand the desire to make it clear that by putting this film up, we are not trying to contribute to the romanticization of the slave era.
Yeah, to be clear on, we referred earlier to the problematic elements of Gone with the Wind. To elaborate a little bit more, the film shows people who own slaves in the South as largely benevolent figures. Obviously, this is not true to life. Also, it showed a situation where people who were slaves were, by and large, oh yeah, we're kind of happy with our situation. This seems okay. Obviously, this was not the case. Separate to that, and this is discussed quite a lot, but there's horrific sexual assault in this movie. And then subsequent to that, the character who's assaulted is shown just to be happy and carefree. And that's definitely... Yeah. Far from okay. And this is also an element that should be addressed in any material that is appended to the film. I'd say further that, though, there is important context as regards Gone with the Wind. And a lot of it is, a recent discussion is centered on the role of Hannah McDaniel. Hannah McDaniel, obviously, won the Best Supporting Actress, was the first African-American woman to win an Academy Award, which in itself is viewed as a historic event. When asked about, obviously, there was some protest among the African-American community over her taking on the role of Gone with the Wind. Her response was, I could be earning significantly less in a menial role, or I could be doing this and earning money for me and my family, and I choose to do this. And certainly I'm not going to contradict her account. I raise this to say that the situation is complex and there are many dimensions to it. And I think there are huge problems with the way the film treats Sarah's history, but I think we can learn a lot from contextual material. And also as a text to show, these were the attitudes that were prevalent at the time of the war. And here's, we're given contextual reading and more information, how these were wrong. Gone with the Wind is a testament to those that this terrible era of history and what we can learn from it. So this sort of thing doesn't ever happen again.
Going back a bit, you just reminded me of something when you were talking about that being a terrible sexual assault, and then it's sort of depicted like that's not such a big thing. This is a big right-wing talking point, but when does it end? You know, once you start picking on films for these kinds of, I agree, in some ways, socially harmful depictions, you know, in the impact they have. I think you can pick up a lot of films throughout history for representing things in ways that maybe weren't so educated about the issues, or downright ignorant or stupid. But where do we stop and where do we draw the line on that? I was shocked when I watched Once Upon a Time in America a couple of years back. Like most of Sergio Leone's movies, it's super misogynist from start to finish, by the way.
But, oh yeah, Noodles was not a good guy. He was portrayed as having a redemptive arc. No, you don't deserve one. You're a piece of shit.
That's exactly right. But in that film, there's a scene during a bank robbery where I think it's kind of entering territory of like, oh, she was raped, but it's okay because she liked it. And then later on, it's played as a gag. It's like, oh, she gets with some guy because she liked it and she can identify him by his penis, but not his face because she had the bag covered over her head. And the whole thing just felt all kinds of gross. You know, like, should you put a disclaimer before Once Upon a Time in America? Should you put a disclaimer before Sunrise, right? Sunrise is my favorite silent film, but it shows a guy who's at the point where he would murder his wife and then argues that it's a good thing that she forgives him and they get to be happily ever after. And it was all the fault of this other wench for tempting him and putting these bad thoughts in his mind.
Yeah.
Like, no, actually, she needs to get far away from him, right? But the film is incredibly well made and tries to sell you on this idea, or at least asks you to just go along with it. Should you put a disclaimer before all these classic films that have morally suspect elements?
Some a disclaimer and some an appropriate rating. Some don't deserve to be seen by, or shouldn't be seen by audiences under a certain age. Absolutely not. I'd count Once Upon a Time in America and Gone with the Wind in that example.
Mm.
Granted, I did see it for the first time when I was under 18.
But I think that the broader point I was just trying to make is that once we start going down this territory, like there's a lot of films throughout history.
Oh, there's a lot. You know, and it's basically a revisionist take on a lot of...
Yeah.
It's not a revisionist take. It's adding to the conversation. I don't have a problem with reading a bunch of essays on Gone with the Wind and watching a bunch of YouTube.
I know. But if you go back to Greek mythology, you know what I mean? Like that all through history that there's... All kinds of, by our current standards, messed up stuff in fiction.
There's a difference in discourse.
Gone with the Wind.
You know, that's the thing. There's a difference in discourse here. right? If I watch a film and then I seek out discourse to basically substantiate my experience of what I've seen, that's a different thing. But if I actually have a disclaimer before I've seen a film, it feels like it's automatically curling my perspective of how I should see it, regardless of what's coming on screen afterwards. I feel like I should be able to make up my mind from the text itself and then seek out commentary as to like, oh, I felt uncomfortable. I felt this was wrong. Is there something that helps substantiate my view out there in discourse? And there, that's fine. But if I basically have a disclaimer telling me that this is how I should feel before I've even seen the film, I feel that's a bit...
I don't think disclaimers necessarily tell you how you should feel. They forewarn you of elements regarding a text. And I'll give you an example. I'm an avid Tintin fan. I have all these books and I have a lot of books about Hergé and the history of Tintin. A lot of them, I have very mixed views on this. A lot of them have very problematic depictions of certain characters and characters of certain races, which have been edited and changed by different animators over time. There's one, however, the second novel, Tintin in the Congo, which is egregious and awful in similar regards to matters we've discussed earlier in this podcast. And the editors, modern editors, have said, "We this is very bad. It's pervasive throughout the text. We decided not to change that, however, give a disclaimer that we believe this was reflective of the attitudes of the time. This is wrong. Here's some extra reading, and here's the text." And then subsequent to that, as I did, I sought out other material on that text. I think that's the appropriate course of action for a lot of films and a lot of texts that people should be doing. But I don't think disclaimers are necessarily bad in that regard. But I do think that if they're too pointed, they subvert what should be the function of explanatory memoranda or additional material that people could seek out before, during, or after they've watched or read a text or a film.
I think that's a pretty nuanced take. And what you describe with the Tintin example is actually similar to what Warner Brothers have done in the past with their Looney Tunes shorts. On the Looney Tunes anthology videos, there are messages before shorts featuring racial stereotypes saying that these reflect the standards of the time. And we've decided, even we don't agree with the depictions here, but we've decided to present as is without editing because we believe in preserving what was there, and we believe that deleting it from the archives would be akin to pretending that these kind of attitudes never existed.
Well, then the thing that usually comes up at this point in the discussion is a film I haven't seen because I certainly don't have access to it, which is Song of the South.
Song of the South. I was thinking about it as soon as you proposed this subject for discussion, actually.
The Disney film. Apparently it's very, very bad in terms of its depictions. I wonder to what extent Disney are doing a disservice to this debate by not making it available with an explanatory memoranda. Certainly Disney have made a lot of films or texts like this over the past, aren't great and should it be out there for discussion.
But this film is a big part of history, right? Like, who doesn't know the song Zippity-Doo-Dah? This song created the iconography for the Splash Mountain ride at Disneyland. That's now being rethemed into a Princess and the Frog ride, but until recently it was all Song of the South themed. It's just strange to me that there's no official release of the film. I get it in the case of Disney, though. It's different from Warner Brothers because Disney is very much about this is appropriate for your kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to raise your kids on racism, right? I think in the case of Song of the South, as far, I haven't seen it. I'm not an expert on what it contains, but I think it's in that kind of like benevolent racism. I'm making quotation marks as I say that.
Yeah.
You know, it's in just the place like of
the
like,
British. They built the railroads, you know, at least fine. You know, why can't you Indians be happy?
Right.
In, what are the roads done for us?
Because I think the thing with Song of the South is that it probably contains a bunch of charming animated short stories, right? But it's the framing device is like the happy slave. He loves his life and he enjoys work. And yeah, it, like...
I know.
It's bad. I'm not in any way saying it's good. It's definitely bad. It's definitely not fit to be just presented as like, here's this Disney classic. But I wonder if... Is it that we don't live in a nuanced enough world for there to be any access to this film that's contextualized? Or am I just being a snob and underestimating people's intelligence to suggest that?
That's the thing. I would want to believe it's the latter, but I think it's the former. You know, I think my good judgment or maybe my naivety is the fact that, you know, I would trust people's judgment and be like, of course, people are smart enough to figure out, you know, that this is not how things are supposed to be. And this is basically applying a 100-year-old standard, which doesn't apply today. But clearly, given the world that we live in and the examples we've seen, it's that people aren't that smart. And that is, I'm still
I think you have to trust people to make, I think if people want to learn about things, everyone does. Give them access to the resources and they will. And certainly I would want to learn more about a lot. I remember when I was a kid watching films that I would watch now and not noticing things that are incredibly problematic and not realizing the extent to which they're very terrible. Certainly, I think a lot of people would grow up watching a film like The Jazz Singer and not knowing the terrible contextual history of blackface. And I'd certainly be perfectly comfortable and very happy with and would absolutely support the idea that any screening or publicly available or digitally available version of that could be appended by, say, videos of academics talking about here's the history of this form and why it is bad. At that time, it was very rare to see a black person in a film and invariably they're not being a villain or in a, it's not Intolerance. Intolerance.
Intolerance, a film that was made by Deep W. Griffith partly to try to clear his conscience after making Birth of a Nation. Because he doesn't touch on intolerance against black people in America. He just made a film about, oh, look at how intolerance is bad throughout history.
Yeah. Sorry, I meant to reference Birth of a Nation. Yes, intolerance is also relevant to this example.
Yeah, he made intolerance off. There was a lot of criticism of Birth of the Nation at the time, despite it being a massive popular success. There were voices speaking out and saying, hold on, this isn't okay. Yeah.
Basically, everyone has a lot of relearning to do, and we still need to figure out what's the best way to do it. I think at least I'm thankful that we're having these conversations, because it's better than shutting them out. Because I think we are exceptions to the rule that we can have these conversations quite openly.
We're geniuses.
But also, I know I'm very conscious of the fact we live in a world where people have kind of already made up their minds. The fact that these conversations that should be had aren't had as regularly and as often and with such civility as we're having on the radio show. We're having a chat. We're not even getting all worked up about it. But a lot of people
just... Did you say worked up?
I had worked up. But look, if you disagree with us on Gone with the Wind, you think it's a film that shouldn't be watched or that is inherently problematic or irreversibly so, let us know.
Yeah.
Or other examples we've mentioned tonight. But I think it's worth watching and in its context... And actually, I think it's worth reading the book, I would say, before watching the film. But
yeah. See everything, educate yourself, understand the context. Don't apply your own lens to everything. Basically, just the world doesn't revolve around you. Just figure it out. It's simple.
Yeah. And Olivia de Havilland, 104. She would actually, you know, I was really hoping when the whole thing happened with HBO Max, I was wondering, would she come out and say something? It's like, hi, I was in the movie. And here's what I think of this.
Was she to be the last person involved in the film still alive?
Well, okay, how old was she at the time? She was in her late 20s?
Yeah, it's very possible.
Late 20s, early 20s, God.
It's very possible she'd be the only person involved in the film still alive. Maybe some
grip.
Maybe like a junior person in the crew.
Well, for what it's worth, the last person involved in The Wizard of Oz, at least the last person to play one of the Munchkins, passed away quite recently. So the same year, I think this era of Hollywood, how many people worked in the old studio system? When
we talk about some grip of, you know, junior staff, these people just didn't get a credit.
Yeah.
The record of whether they actually worked on the film is probably lost.
And Gone with the Wind had like, what, 20 directors? So.
Yeah. It was the archetypical producer-driven film.
Oh, God. It was such a... phenomenon at the time. Like the Mitchell novel was the biggest thing. It was like the Da Vinci Code when it came out. And then the film was
it was
that kind of massive social phenomenon. Yeah,
everyone read it, everyone was talking about it. The film was the biggest film.
It was a huge talent quest essentially throughout America to find Scarlett O'Hara.
Vivian,
because like everyone knew and loved the character already.
She was such ideal casting. I mean, she wasn't like she was described in the book, but she was ideal casting.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
Clark Gable, he had a very distinct voice. Scarlett, my pet.
Yes, that's correct.
Sean Connery and Clark Gable a little bit indistinguishable, but
it was a bit Sean Connery.
Is it so hard to do a Clark Gable?
To nail the Sean, it's only 50% the accent. Sean Connery is actually about just that low monotone.
What?
Like
Sean?
Parked him in the garage. Like.
Shocking. Positively shocking. Right. Clark Gable had this upward inflection. It's very hard to do.
positively shocking.
Yeah, Clark Gable was amazing. And actually, the actor who played Ashley Wilkes had an incredible career. He was also a war hero. Fleming, obviously, hadn't made many major films. And also,
it's visually stunning, though. Gone with the Wind has some absolutely incredible, highly storyboarded sequences. Like the fire. Oh, my God.
Oh, collapsing the building. The sequence where it pans out that The Simpsons parodied in the trampoline sequence, where there's just hundreds of bodies. Watching The Simpsons, and I was watching Gone with the Wind for the first time, I was like, Simpsons, 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 Simpsons.
You know, Brad Bird actually brought a lot of those film references to the classic Simpsons. That was one of his big influences over the show.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so many famous, still the most probably iconic line in the history of cinema. I don't think there's ever been so much anticipation of a film ever. Dark Knight was not as big as Gone with the Wind, guys. Otherwise,
no, yeah, Gone with the Wind was possibly the biggest film of all time. Sound of Music would be up there as well. And E.T. and Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah.
I'm not sure there's anything else on that level.
Okay, apparently, I'm just looking this up.
Mr. Buzz, yeah.
I'm just looking this up.
Not nearly as good.
The only surviving credited cast member from the film still alive is Mickey Coon, who played Melanie's son, Bo.
Wow.
Wow.
That's incredible. Okay. That's good. That's a good piece of trivia. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Good to know.
This is after, as of the death of Olivia de Havilland.
So, yeah. How old is he? 90, Coon, I'm guessing.
Must have been, yeah, very young.
Yeah.
I don't know how old, but Mickey Coon, okay, let me see. He's 87 as of, yeah.
Good for you, mate.
Good for him.
Good for you. Gone with the Wind. It's rapturous. It does go along at a very strong pace. And a lot of it is the charisma of Gable and Lee.
Apparently he was only a child actor. He never did anything as an actual actor.
As an actual actor? Well, he was an actual child actor.
As an adult actor. That's what I meant.
Well,
at least he didn't become
like
an actual cannibal after being a child actor, like Shia LaBeouf.
He's at a very young age. Fair enough.
Well, his last credited appearance is in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. So, yeah.
There you go. Well,
Alfred Hitchcock Presents, that kid from Gone with the Wind. Behold, an adult.
Imagine that, like, hey, kids, I was a Gone with the Wind. Like, I was the son of one of the four major characters.
Yeah,
like, that's me.
I was, back in the day, I was the kid.
You were. You and Shirley were, like, bee's knees. I'm talking about Shirley Temple. She was big. For those playing at home. Shirley Temple. Oh, the studio era. Well, let us know what you want us to fight about.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great if we could become people who like yearn for all the terrible aspects of the studio era? Like, we can become the film version of like the but the South wasn't so bad, and we can like talk about like how great it was, Shirley Temple and like you know, Judy Garland and stuff, and just not mention the horrible exploitation behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard does shine a bit.
Sunset Boulevard shone a light on it to some extent. The dark undercurrents.
Yeah. No, but it was a glorious time, a wonderful time.
Exactly.
The golden age of Hollywood.
That's the kind of the thing that rubs me the wrong way. I mean, this breed's dying out, but a lot of the classic film enthusiasts who talk about it in that way, not just glossing over the exploitation, but it's also like a lot of the films weren't that good, you know?
Most of them were bad.
That's what I was going to say, not just a lot. Out. But in general, the films weren't that good. It's just like I'm not a fan of nostalgia just for nostalgia's sake.
Like Elvis made their bad films. I love all those, but a lot of them bad. Were just no, but they're fun bad.
You know, I watched late at night because it popped on TV, and I thought, oh man, I have to watch this. I think it's called Spin Out. Have you seen that?
No.
It's an Elvis movie where his character just wants to play in my band and race automobiles. Like
I want to say for the record that Chris's Elvis impression is much better than my Clark Gable impression.
Thank you. But thank you very much. But he's driving around America. Like he's a professional racer, but he's also like playing in a band that he's going around touring. And there's a woman pursuing him because she's a journalist, and she realizes that he represents the archetypical manly American man.
He's always just like in a band or doing something else. Like he's running his lead band for a club owner. Club owner's like, go out and make sure my girlfriend doesn't get with any of those, you know, beach boys. She's like, oh yeah. And then he obviously falls in love with her and plays in a band. He's working as the fitness at a fitness camp. He's playing in a band. There's one where he breaks into the prison where it's all like 22-year-old girls in the prison. And he's like, I'm looking for Daisy. And one of the women's like, I'll be your Daisy. And it's just the whole... Oh, kissing cousins when he breaks into Kitty Hawk Mountain, where everyone who lives there is his distant cousin, but not too distant for him, as the lyric goes, and they're all 22 and look exact, and it's so weird.
Oopsie daisy.
These movies were insane. So that's Elvis. We can talk about Elvis movies in another week.
He was sick of doing them by the end. He was just like, please, no more movies. Like, he was just contracted to do all these terrible films.
They basically went to him and said, look, we've got this set available for a few weeks, so you can make a film out of these sets. And they just
another Elvis movie. Elvis. Here it comes. You didn't ask for it, but here it is.
Remember when they made films in like 3 weeks?
Sometimes it still happens today. Some indie film shoots, people really rehearse it. They know what they're doing. They get in, get it done, get out.
You can film an episode of TV in a week. That's 45 minutes.
Yeah. Get it? I think sometimes indie films work on these TV-like schedules to get it done, to just keep the budget down.
So pick a fight with us. You can be Please on Elvis do. Or anything else.
You can find us on social media at twitter.com/filmfightclubAU or facebook.com/filmfightclub. We're way slacker updating these pages than we should be. But you can send us a message and we promise we will read it.
Send us what you want us to fight about.
We'll talk next week. Have a wonderful day whenever you're listening. Enjoy movies.
A Wonderful Life. Now, It's a Wonderful Life. Now, that was a film.
It was a movie. I hope there's no storied studio history behind that one.
Oh, I'm sure there is. There's always darkness behind every beautiful, innocent page.
Damn it, George Bailey. Okay. This has been Glenn Falcon and Chris Evans of Rotten Eru. Stay safe, enjoy movies, and have a good night.